The committee will convene.
This is my second favorite.
Thank you, members, for being here bright and early.
Good morning.
We have, in many ways, a simple agenda this morning, but a very important agenda. We're going to be talking STEM stuff. We've got some great presenters with us today to do that. But before I do that, do we have a quorum? We do have a quorum. And Representative Dietrich, if you'd be so kind as to move our minutes from the January 16th meeting, I'd appreciate it.
So moved.
The January 16th minutes have been moved. Any discussion? All in favor of approving the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. As promised, I do want to continue our discussion among committee members. Lou, I'm looking right at Representative Hornstein. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to barge in on Representative Norness over there and ask him to get us started. Just sharing a little bit of information about your district and your goals and what you think are the most important issues. And then Representative Hornstein, you're up next.
Okay, thank you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I look forward to this opportunity.
I look forward to working with you. I served with you last couple of years in the Higher Ed Committee. You were our chairperson, a very good chairperson.
Right.
I really appreciate working with you over the years.
Well, again, I appreciate being on this committee. I represent District 10A, which is in West Central Minnesota. Specifically, it's the west half of Otter Tail County, if you know where that is. And geographically, we're located halfway between Moorhead and Alexandria, 190 miles from here. I have four school districts that are in my district, several really on the edge of my district. One of them is, I share with Representative Paul Marquardt. The highway splits Rotsay in half, and he's got the west half where the school is located. I've got the east half where the wealthier people live.
Uh-oh.
I shouldn't say that. But it's the newer part of town. The issues in my district, as far as education goes, first of all, I have to say we've got excellent schools. I think that we've got really no problem with quality in any of the schools that I represent. The continuing problem, however, is declining enrollment, aging buildings, and actually competition. There are a lot of students that go from district to district, and that's probably a good thing. Depends on what side you're on, but we actually have small districts that are enticing students from the large district, which is kind of opposite of what you would think would happen, and so people are choosing to go into the small district often because of for various reasons. It may be perceived specific quality or opportunity, athletic opportunity, whatever it might be. And so that's really the kind of the unusual thing I'd say in my district, is that instead of the big school district gobbling up the small schools, it's kind of, right now, it's the opposite. And a lot of students also choose to go into to be homeschooled. That's kind of another phenomenon. It's well over 200 students, I think, in my district that are homeschooled. So we have challenges, but again, the major one in Fergus Falls, where I live, it's buildings. How do we downsize to proper fit the student population now? So you got old buildings, too large buildings, and the inability to pass the bond issue that it would take because of the impact on property tax. So we're still struggling with that one.
Thank you, Representative Norness. My fellow MAC alum, Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and I really appreciate this opportunity to share kind of beyond the usual just introductions. I represent District 60B, which is the southwest part of Minneapolis. And if you're familiar with the city of Minneapolis, these are the neighborhoods around two beautiful lakes, Lakes Calhoun and Lakes Harriet. And my interest in education, I think, really stems in many ways from my personal family background. My parents are immigrants. They came to this country after World War II, and they said very often to me that they came with nothing except their education. They after the war they were able to get a very reduced fee, almost free medical education in Germany, and they were physicians. But over and over they talked and emphasized education. It was a key value in our home. But in terms of my background with education policy and issues, that happened about 10 years ago when I was asked to join our site council for my kids' public school in Minneapolis Barton Open School, and there were some real budget issues and budget pressures, and so I think my mission was to help organize the parents to put pressure on the school board, and familiar story. My background is in community organizing, so that fit very nicely. And I got very interested in, you know, schools at that point, and through that experience realized how complex it is just to manage an individual school site. The principals, all the different players involved, and got very interested then in education issues through that. Once I was elected, we have huge problems, as you well know, in the Minneapolis school district with the achievement gap and various other issues. And having my kids in the schools, I saw firsthand some of the problems, and particularly over the last few years with class sizes. And so that's been one of the key issues as I door knocked and talked to parents in my district. For example, my kids at South High School have had 35 to 40 kids per class. And so that's going to be a concern as I bring forward issues as well as legislation. Secondly, very concerned about assessments and testing. I think there's a huge role for that when used appropriately. But I've had a lot of concerns personally as well as in talking with parents, teachers, administrators in the schools in my district about how these assessments are used. And I look forward to a conversation about that in the committee. And finally, Mr. Chair, I'm very interested in parents' involvement. I was really pleased to hear so many people on the committee discuss that. I've looked at models around the country also, I'm going to bring forward some legislation in terms of how we can support parents, particularly in immigrant and low-income communities, to get involved in individual school sites. We have some studies in Texas that have shown a real correlation between parent involvement, particularly in school management and achievement, which is fascinating. So I'll look forward to sharing some of that information with the committee as we move forward. So thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I appreciate it. We'll be talking a little bit about assessments and testing today in regards to science and math, so hopefully you'll get a chance to plug in with some questions today. We're going to talk about science and math issues, the acronym STEM, which I was not aware of maybe a year ago, but now is common language for most of us, science, technology, engineering, and math. How'd I do? Okay, good. Is an emerging public policy concern across the country. It's also an emerging policy concern for both our public and private industries because of the increasing demand for competency in these disciplines in virtually all professional classes nowadays. And so what we're going to do today is hear from three individuals. First, we're going to hear from Bill Linder Schroller, who's with the ADC Foundation. ADC, as you know, is one of our premier high-tech telecommunications businesses in Minnesota. We're also going to ask our very own Lisa Larson to do a presentation for us on the role of our assessment and standards scheme in this regard, and then we're going to hear from Nancy Nutting, who is the Executive Director of SciMath Minnesota, and I hope that we, in fact, will have a good give and take and good question and answer period this morning. So, without any further ado, I'm going to ask Mr. Linder Schroller to come forward and identify himself for the record and give us your testimony. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you for this invitation. I'm Bill Linder Schroller. I work for ADC Telecommunications, which is headquartered in Eden Prairie, Minnesota. I'm Director of Corporate Community Relations and also Director of the ADC Foundation. That's ADC's charitable arm. I'm also a member of the SciMathMin board, so I have a connection with one of the other presenters this morning. ADC is, as the chair has already explained, is a telecom company, and we are in many ways, I think, an example of what I'll be talking about, or this whole question of STEM education and its role in a changing global work environment. ADC provides network infrastructure, that's cables, fiber, switches, the hardware that makes telecom systems work. We have major operations not only in the United States, but in some 20 countries, and we sell into more than 140 countries. We've been through tough times recently, like the rest of our industry, battered by global economic forces, the digital revolution, and the continuing restructuring of industry. The very forces that are driving the global changes that Tom Friedman describes in The World is Flat, if you know that book. Saying it another way, we represent the kind of changes that have made STEM education a critical issue for economic competitiveness. We're a business based on worldwide activity and supply chain. We seek talent wherever we can find it and wherever we need it. We're not high tech, but we're tech oriented in product, process, and a skill base wherein math and science skills are highly valued. So the question that was posed to me, and I was asked to speak very briefly to this topic, is why, from a Minnesota employer's perspective, is STEM education important to preparing our state's future workforce for global competition? Well, you should know that STEM education is a hot topic in the business world. Almost every meeting I've been to recently of businesses has addressed this issue in one fashion or another. And at the national level, there have been a spate of reports on the relationship between education, the U.S. economy, and our position globally. And I can tell you what those reports say very quickly. They all refer to a new era of global competition. They express concerns over the workplace skills of the current workforce and or call for a new set of 21st century workplace skills. Several of them warn that our technological superiority really is slipping, that we may be at risk, and they emphasize that critical relationship between education, particularly in science and math, and our continuing economic viability. All of them, without exception, see STEM education as the key, or one of the keys, to making the changes we need to make. Most of the reports also directly address the issue of equity for low-performing students whose needs are not being met, by the way. And here's the net message. Math and science skills in all of these reports are seen as no longer interesting pursuits for a few, but requirements for all students. That's the bottom line. So just a little bit more about what's going on underneath those big ideas. The world of work is changing, really driven by two primary forces. And if you haven't read Tom Friedman's book, The World is Flat, I'd recommend it to you. He lays it out wonderfully and very accessibly. But the digital revolution and the telecommunications revolution are the primary drivers for business activity going globally. As Friedman puts it, computers are everywhere. Cable and fiber have linked the world. And so if you have a computer and you have technical skills, you can plug and play. You can be part of the world's economy. That's really changing how U.S. business does business. And the other major force that is going on, again, that Friedman describes, is the deconstruction of the traditional business model. For many decades, U.S. businesses have built up vertical kind of businesses. They owned all the pieces of their business and wanted to have them internally. What's happening now, driven by global competition and particularly telecommunications, is that businesses look around the world and say, who could do what we need to do better, faster, cheaper, smarter? And if there are other players, businesses will take that part of the business to where those players are. Most of us know that phenomenon as outsourcing, but it's really global sourcing of business activity and search for talent. Again, education, technical skills, all the more critical these days. This kind of global competitiveness means that we businesses have to benchmark our activity globally. And the speed of business reports I refer to make the same point about education, particularly in math and science, world-class benchmarking. And Nancy Nutting, when she does her presentation on TIMS, will make that point in great detail. Companies will pay a premium for technical training and innovative thinking, in other words, wherever they find it. And so that's a clear message, I think, to those of us in the United States and those of us here in Minnesota about what we need to do for our kids to give them a chance at a good future. Friedman addresses a couple of other issues that are critical, and one is simply a numbers gap. With the baby boomer retirement coming at us, there's a huge demographic shift going on in the workplace, particularly in the technical workplace, major retirements among technical workforce, and that coupled with education achievement gaps at the K-12 level set up a dangerous collision. I was struck by a couple of details I found in one of the reports on the demographic changes, because at the same time we're facing those changes in the United States, other countries, and the examples you hear frequently are China and India, are moving very aggressively to educate more and more scientists and engineers. Here's the number that grabbed me. By the year 2010, if current demographic trends continue, more than 90% of all scientists and engineers in the world will be living in Asia. So what does that say for what we need to do for our kids in science and math if we want them to be competitive? By 2010, more than 90% living in Asia. Another one. In China, undergraduate enrollment rates are expanding at a rate 10 times faster than they are here in the United States. Three-quarters of those undergraduates will earn degrees in STEM. Fully three-quarters in STEM, compared to a rate that's about one-third of graduates in the United States right now. Well, I think you see the point. Major shifts demographically, educationally, and in terms of the business model. It's been a quiet crisis, but and that happens to be the chapter of Friedman's section on K-12 education, but I would suggest it's not very quiet anymore. It's staring us right in the face. Minnesota's always done well, as you all know, in K-12 education and math and science. Overall, I think the point we need to focus on now is that our historically strong academic performance, though, is for some time masks serious gaps for some of our students, achievement gaps, and we really need to focus in on that. And then after we solve that problem, we've got to figure out how we can attract more of our young people to careers in science and engineering. That's a huge issue that we'll all have to work on. One of my favorite lines in Friedman's book was just comparing what's going on in this country, in that sense, relative lack of interest in careers in science and technology by our young people, to what's going on in China. And he makes the point that when Bill Gates, chairman and CEO of Microsoft, travels to China, he's mobbed like a rock star. Hence the line, in China, Bill Gates is Britney Spears. and I think Friedman adds to that then, and the other problem is that in the United States, Britney Spears is Britney Spears. In other words, who are young people looking up to? Well, what's our role as a state in strengthening math and science education for all kids? There are many suggestions, by the way, many and different in these national reports, but it seems to me that basically it's about having high expectations for all kids and then adjusting and aligning the system to really deliver on that. And that's probably what we face at this point in time. We now have increased the expectation in mathematics and science for all kids in Minnesota, legislative action last year. And now can we deliver is the question. Can schools deliver? There is a business group at the national level called Achieve. They will be looking at our state standards, I believe, benchmarking them, our newly revised math standards. They did a work a couple of years ago called Ready or Not, and its central point was about the importance of continuing to try to align what a high school diploma means. In other words, what are our expectations for kids, and how does that really connect to the world of work and the world of higher education? And they point out that for too many years, for decades really, high school diploma has been ignored. Workers didn't pay attention to it. It wasn't all that significant in terms of college admissions. So, too high expectations and making them real. I should point out that in terms of skills employers are looking for, it's more than just STEM. STEM, of course, isn't the only answer. As ABC recruits, as 3M recruits, as other businesses recruit, they're looking not only for those skills, but also for the kind of higher order thinking skills that are absolutely necessary in the workplace. And, oh, by the way, cross-cultural skills and training are important, too. ADC employs 9,000 individuals, about 1,200 here in the state of Minnesota, about half of the total in the United States, but fully half of our employees are not U.S. nationals. Live and work around the world. We need to know how to communicate with each other. And finally, I'd make this point, that it seems to me that this interest in STEM education isn't just about future technical workers. It's really about giving all our kids a better chance for their futures. And to that end, I'd leave you with the following two factoids. The courses in high school that a student takes, particularly math and science and English, are more predictive of success than family, income, or race. I find that a pretty powerful fact. The courses a student takes in high school, I have two high school daughters, so I'm very aware of it, are more predictive of success than family, income, or race. And then the second one, and Nancy, I'm sorry I stole this from your presentation, the single strongest predictor of college completion is the highest level of mathematics completed by the student. So that high school algebra requirement, it makes sense. It's powerful. That concludes my remarks, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Linda Scholler. I appreciate it. I appreciate your helping us to put this issue in several contexts. A global context. Also, putting it into a private sector context. And both of those really calling for a number of issues related to our ability to communicate well and effectively with other cultures around the world who are all rushing, apparently, to fill in their competency in STEM disciplines. I suspect that the other issue that you raised in terms of the relevancy of this to the achievement gap issues, I suspect for some of our rural members, they might want to add to that some concerns about whether or not communities around the state that are perhaps off the beaten course in terms of the Twin Cities high-tech critical mass That those communities, I think, I suspect, would also be should have some concern in making sure that they're tapping into the opportunities that await in the emerging economy with STEM disciplines for their students. And of course, we've heard from many members last week about some of the struggles many of those smaller communities around the state have, even just providing general discipline education, much less adding to their capacity to really explore the STEM field. So I think that this is an agenda that really in many ways ties all sorts of communities of interest together. I thank you for helping us tie those things together. Are there any questions at this point for Mr. Lindenschuler? Representative Hornstein?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Leonard, is there evidence, or I'm sure people are studying this, that the curriculum in these Asian countries on math and science, how does that, you know, compare to our curriculum, particularly in places where we're maybe doing it right? Can we learn anything from, like, do they have the equivalent of, you know, AP physics or whatever at a certain grade level, or what's it like over there?
Mr. Lindenschuler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, the short answer is there are some things we can learn in terms of not only how we're doing in terms of test scores, but what we can learn from schools in the high-performing countries, the way they do school. And I'll defer to Nancy Netting, who will be presenting in a minute. She's got some great detail. But if we pay attention to those practices, there are things we can learn and use here that would improve what we teach, curriculum, and how we teach it. Absolutely.
Representative
Gottwald. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and testifier. Mr. Winter, I'm sorry I wasn't able to be here for the entire presentation, but as a multimedia communications practitioner and somebody who's worked in economic development fairly extensively, I, you know, absolutely to everything that you said. I'm wondering if you could comment briefly on your reaction, if you're familiar with the governor's proposal of offering a couple years of free college to people who do focus as kind of an incentive to get young people to focus on the science and technology areas. Are you familiar with that proposal, and do you have any reaction?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not. I don't know the details. Just hearing it this way would seem to make sense. I think incentives of all kinds do make sense. Beyond that, I can't comment.
Representative Peterson.
No, we talk about the high school math curriculum, et cetera, but really the beginnings of the math really start in the elementary schools. And I'm wondering, with the new math standards and all of the expectations around math, if the higher ed institutions are working with our elementary teachers and if we're providing the kind of professional development that's needed to really start getting students on the road to being interested in science and math and being able to succeed later in life.
Mr. Lindenschuler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, that's a big question. And I don't really have the background to adequately answer, but I can tell you that it's interesting that in a number of these business reports that I did review for today's presentation, the issue of teaching is front and center, and particularly the math and science backgrounds of elementary teachers. So I think there is attention to the issues that your question raises. I'd then have to let others respond to exactly what are our professional development programs in Minnesota higher ed institutions doing about that. I think they're doing a lot, but I don't know all the specifics.
Okay. Representative Peterson.
I think in addition, I know that SciMath has done a great deal of professional development over a period of time with elementary teachers, and I would hope that they would consider continuing to offer that kind of professional development. And I think we need to pay attention to professional development in the future for all of our teachers, but particularly in the science and math and the elementary.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Representative Heikerg, and then we're going to move on.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. Just a comment, and when I look at numbers and stats, we're looking at numbers and stats the last couple of days with the achievement gap. I just recently spent a couple weeks over in Malaysia, and they had problems similar to we have. They have a highly mobile society, a lot of Indians moving into that their society. When that happens, as it happens over here, I think China, some of the countries, when you look at it, they're doing very well. It means it, countries that do well and states that do well do not skew their numbers. They have societies that where the people are have been there for a while. There's not like the whites, for example, have done very well in the achievement gap. I mean, in the results, it's because they're not as mobile. And when I look at the numbers, I know that I'm not sure how China plays out in comparison to the United States. But when we look at the total numbers of where students are, you know, we don't sometimes take in consideration it takes a while. I know it took my ancestry. My dad never was able to, my grandmother and grandfather, I spoke to them, I had to speak German. I know for a fact that my dad may have struggled in school because he could not speak English. I know for a fact if I move my family to Malaysia, my family's going to not only have a culture shock, but a language shock. And I don't think it would be fair for my students if I moved to Malaysia to be figured into the stats. I think it takes a while to assimilate. Then you look at the stats. But I'm looking at the numbers where we sit globally. And I think that there's a lot of countries that are experiencing a growth factor right now. And sometimes those numbers don't play out fairly. Just your comments on that.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative, I would respond this way. There's been concern for all of us who've studied TIMSS and international testing in general about the very issues you raise. But what the experts tell us is that the latest rounds, the last 10 years or so, these things have been very valid and hence comparable. In other words, the issues you raised might have accounted for some international differences early on, many years ago. That's no longer the case. And those same experts remind us that other countries are now struggling, as you point out, with the same kind of demographic changes that we face. So I think that we really can trust the numbers from a study like TIMSS.
Thank you. Thank you again, Mr. Linda Schuller, and I hope that you'll be able to stick around. Again, we'll do some more question and answer, and I appreciate you being here early this morning and helping us frame up this very important issue.
Thank you.
So next we're going to hear from Lisa Larson from House Research. Ms. Larson is going to share with us the what's already been referenced several times, which is the direction that was handed to the Commissioner on Education to revise our state's academic standards in this area. And she'll do a brief walkthrough of what that what the intent was and what that looks like.
Mr. Chairman, members, good morning. Christina asked me to briefly cover with you the statutory parameters that govern the authority of the Education Commissioner to change the substance of the state's academic standards and its related benchmarks. And she may have asked me to do this in part because the legislature has been actively involved in the evolution of standards, certainly since 1990, when a decision was made to repeal the Carnegie units. And the legislature began to explore ideas related to outcome-based education, then the profile of learning, pursued the profile of learning with a great deal of discussion, and then repealed the profile of learning to implement this newest chapter of academic standards. And so what I'd like to talk with you today about is the evolution of this latest chapter between 2003 and 2005 in establishing the standards initially and the related benchmarks, and then the directions that the legislature gave the commissioner in 2006. So to begin, in 2003, the Minnesota legislature repealed the profile of learning, that portion of the graduation rule. There's also a basic standards portion which remains in effect, although it is evolving. And it also adopted requirements for academic standards in five subject areas: language arts, math, science, social studies, and the arts. And how the legislature did this is that it incorporated by reference, and you can find the reference in the 2003 laws if you're curious, the substance of three report or three academic standard committee proposals. If you look in the law, you will see the date, May 19, 2003. The language arts, math, and art standards are all incorporated by reference, and it was those documents that were, in fact, put into rule at the direction of the legislature. In addition, that 2003 legislature directed the education commissioner to submit in 2004 to the legislature proposed science and social studies standards. At the time the 2003 standards were adopted, the legislature authorized the commissioner to use expedited rulemaking to adopt the statewide standards in language arts, math, and arts. These are the three standards that have been incorporated by reference. The expedited rulemaking process requires an agency to publish notice of its proposed rules, but does not require a public comment period. However, an ALJ, an administrative law judge, does review the legality of the proposed rule before it is published as a final rule. At that time, the 2003 legislature also directed the education commissioner to submit proposed science and social studies standards in 2004. The rulemaking authority of the commissioner was circumscribed because the legislature specifically prohibited the commissioner from amending or repealing or adopting new rules on the same topic without specific legislative authorization. In 2004, the legislature amended the rulemaking authority of the commissioner to say that the commissioner could adopt rules to include science and social studies standards, and those rules would apply to students beginning in 2005-2006. The earlier standards applied beginning 2004-2005. In addition, the 2004 legislature adopted locally developed health and physical education standards as a sixth required subject area. As you know, the state has statewide standards in math, science, language arts, and social studies. There are also state art standards, but districts can elect to implement local art standards instead. Public school students must take state-developed math, science, and language arts tests. Students also take locally selected assessments in the arts, social studies, health, physical education, career and technical education, and world languages. Limited English proficiency students take tests of emerging academic English in reading, writing, listening, speaking, and they are subject to the same graduation requirements as all other students. To support the standards, the commissioner also developed something we called benchmarks. Benchmarks supplement academic standards with published grade-level content related to academic knowledge and skills. Schools must offer these benchmarks, and students must achieve them to satisfy the standards. The benchmarks are not subject to rulemaking, but the commissioner may change the benchmarks only with specific legislative authority after completing a review of the standards and the benchmarks related to those standards. That is the status of the commissioner's authority through 2005. In 2006, this past legislative session, the Minnesota legislature directed the commissioner to do a number of things with respect to the academic standards. It asked that the commissioner embed technology and information literacy skills into the state's academic standards. It directed the commissioner to examine the alignment of the state standards and related benchmarks in the context of knowledge and skills that students need to be ready for college and work. And it directed the commissioner to implement a review cycle for state academic standards and related benchmarks. And the commissioner has done this. The 2006 legislature directed the commissioner to revise not only the state's math standards, which you'll hear discussed today, but all of the state's academic standards according to a specific timeline. It is as follows. The commissioner is to revise the academic math standards in the 2006-2007 school year, and they are to be implemented in the 2010-2011 school year. The math standards were enhanced by the 2006 legislature in the following way. One algebra credit will be required by the end of eighth grade for all students, and graduates in the 2014-2015 school year must complete algebra 2 credit. The commissioner is directed to revise the art standards in the 2007-2008 school year, and they are to be implemented in the 2010-2011 school year. The science standards are to be revised in 2008-2009 school year, and they will be implemented in the 2011-2012 school year. The language arts standards are to be revised in 2009-2010 school year to be implemented in the 2012-2013 school year. And finally, the last of the statewide standards, the social studies standards, are to be revised in the 2010-2011 school year to be implemented in the 2013-2014 school year. In addition, there are local academic standards to remember. The legislature directed school districts and charter schools to establish a periodic review cycle. No specific timeline is established in law for the local academic standards in health and physical education, career and technical education, and world languages. And the districts and the charter schools are charged with determining the school year when students are required to complete the revised local standards. It is my understanding that the commissioner has currently undertaken the following process in revising the academic math standards. A committee has been formed of teachers, school administrators, and representatives of the business community to draft the revised standards. A draft was prepared. The department sought and received public comment throughout the state on that first draft. It revised it, created a second draft. The second draft, as I understand it, is being reviewed by expert reviewers, such as national agencies, like ACHIEVE. The department anticipates it may need as many as four drafts. That's not clear at this time. And it anticipates submitting the final draft to the legislature, I think, hopefully by the end of February. So to kind of say to you, this is the status of the current chapter of the academic standards. The legislature has been actively involved. It sets the parameters, and it can delegate as it has here. You should know that the authority to make these decisions resides with you.
Thank you, Ms. Larson. Just a quick question, again, just for my own clarity. At the point at which the commissioner submits the final draft, hopefully this year, and I had heard also by the end of February, does the framework require an affirmative action on the part of this body in regards to those?
Mr. Chairman, members, this process that I've just described to you that the commissioner is undertaking, it is something the commissioner has elected to do. There is no requirement that the commissioner gain the approval of the legislature. The law directs the commissioner to revise the standards and to implement them in a certain school year in the future.
And of course, being the legislature, we can obviously enter back in and establish some proactive measures if for whatever reason we're not in agreement with the revised standards. I mean, I think that's always a prerogative of the legislature. One other question real quickly from me anyway. Aside from looking through the statutes, is there like a cheat sheet for members to be able to refer to in terms of the schedule?
Mr. Chairman, members, it is in the statute. I'd be glad to prepare a cheat sheet if you would like. I think, as a matter of fact, well, maybe not.
I don't want to make work for you. I'm just trying to facilitate for members who might be. I was jotting notes furiously and didn't get all my notes in. But.
Mr. Chairman, members, in section 120B.023, subdivision 2, paragraph B, the timeline is laid out.
Okay.
Paragraph B addresses the MAP standards. Paragraph C, the art standards, and so D, the science standards, and so forth.
So, Ms. Larson, in our wisdom, we created the cheat sheet in statute, so
yes.
Thank you. Representative Welty, I think you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Larson, I'm wondering if we could get a copy of your testimony.
Ms. Larson?
I would appreciate that. I think a couple of the other members around me would appreciate that as well. Because I didn't take notes, because as soon as you started going, I knew there was a lot of in-depth context in that, and I couldn't keep up. So I'd appreciate it if you could provide us with a copy. Thank you.
Representative Gutwald, did you have a question? No? Okay. Thank you, Ms. Larson. Next, we'll hear from Nancy Nutting with SciMath, Minnesota. Developing world-class students through world-class mathematic standards. Welcome, Ms. Nutting.
Good morning. Representative Mariani, Chair Mariani, and members of the committee, I'm pleased to be here. I'm Nancy Nutting. I'm Executive Director of SciMath Minnesota. There are three documents I'll be referring to this morning. The first one is a paper we developed last week for a briefing we did for state policymakers on developing world-class standards, and I'll point out the cheat sheet part of that document for you in a moment. There's also a short PowerPoint handout that describes SciMath Minnesota. And the third part I'll be referring to is Bill Schmidt's address that was given last week, Education World Contest. SciMath Minnesota last week presented a briefing for state policymakers, and several legislators were able to attend, but several of you were not, so we're bringing the presentation to you. SciMath is a nonprofit organization founded in 1993. We actually had legislative funding at the beginning of our development. We are now totally a nonprofit. We are housed at the Science Museum of Minnesota and work collaboratively with Dr. Jolly and the museum staff and several initiatives. What makes us unique is we are a business and education partnership, not one or the other. And we're really interested in advocating for math, science, and technology based on the research of the that is current, the national standards and effective practices. This was a statement made by Bill Linderscholler in his presentation. We've done quite well in Minnesota for the aggregate when we look at our comparison to other states. We're often among the first, second, or third, whether it's NAEP, the ACT, or the SAT. But we are not among the best in the world, especially in mathematics. We're pretty mediocre worldwide. Interestingly, I'll share some results about science, where we are among the best in the world. And part of that is, what are other countries doing that might give us some guidance, particularly as we look at the development of our standards? Here's a few facts. The other hidden fact with our aggregated strength in achievement is that we are not strong in achievement for all of our students. The final sentence here, students of color and low-income students take fewer high school math courses, they perform less well in assessments, they complete high school at lower rates, although some of them complete high school just on a longer time frame. So some of our data has to always be taken with a grain of salt and look for other hidden results behind that. And they complete college at lower rates. But as we pass this new legislation for Algebra 1 and Algebra 2, thinking of Dr. Martin Luther King's holiday this week, I wanted to put this one in from another civil rights worker, Robert Moses, who was one of the freedom riders that helped with voter registration. He now says algebra is the new civil right. Algebra is really not the end-all and be-all, but it is certainly the means to an end. And we need that algebra to be there for all of our kids. All children deserve to learn important and challenging mathematics, and it's SciMath's position that we advocate for that. We would even say kids need mathematics every year of their school life. Algebra is critically important since it's the gateway. This is one of the quotes that Bill Linderscholler referred to. It is in our paper, that completing a course beyond advanced algebra, such as pre-calculus or statistics, more than doubles the chance that a student will complete a college degree.
Ms. Fleming, I just want to interrupt very quickly because you may notice some of us are smiling, and what's happening behind you is that the screen keeps flickering, and we are going to work awfully hard to make sure that gets fixed here, but we don't want you to get any wrong messages from our
So we've got kind of imperfect technology. We've got a little verbal. We've got the paper. We're trying to, you know, do all modes of learning here, so we'll just work with that.
Ms. Chairman? I asked the Chair Davids to fix that a year ago, and it's still flickering.
Well, we'll get his phone number. We'll give him a call. Pursue this study.
And so here's another single strongest predictor of bachelor's completion is those courses. And the number of college and university math courses taken is the single greatest predictor of lifetime earning potential. That one does grab kids' attention a little bit. But just taking courses is not always the end-all and be-all, too. On the ACT test, 58% of the students indicate they've taken college-ready courses, but only 28% of them act or perform on the assessment as if they had taken those courses. So again, it's that Carnegie unit, seat time versus what are kids really learning. So we have a regulation that says Algebra 1, Algebra 2. How will we guarantee that the learning is going to happen and be retained in those courses? In our paper, we set out three key points. We need world-class standards to support our state economy and to prepare our future citizens. Knowing and understanding contemporary mathematics is a key competency for a highly qualified workforce and citizenry. But to be effective, standards must be embedded in a world-class system. That means our learning materials must be aligned, and it seems that we cannot just import them from other nations. Some people do that. Those of you that have people that homeschool often go to Singapore and buy the textbooks. I've had an opportunity to visit in the Singapore schools. You can't just import the textbooks and learning materials from one country to another country. But there are some important lessons learned that I'll touch on in just a moment. But it's also our instruction, our assessment. Are our assessments truly aligned to test what we really want our students to be learning? And as Representative Peterson brought up, it's really going to be about professional development. Once we have world-class standards, we have to guarantee that they are going to happen for students. And that means we need to move to the professional development level. Now, this is part of your cheat sheet. On the second page of the paper written by SciMath are some criteria that we think you should have in mind when you look at the standards that come before you in February. And the first one is probably the key one. You need to look for focus, coherence, and that they are non-repetitive. Now, I need to make a public disclaimer here. I was a member of the committee that wrote the 2003 standards under which our state is currently operating. I applied as an individual. I'm a retired Minneapolis teacher. I am still a licensed teacher in Minnesota. I happen to be a unique elementary teacher because I do have a math master's degree in math education. Only 4-7% of elementary teachers have any specialization in mathematics. So it was kind of a no-brainer that I got picked to be on the committee. I spent about 200 hours working on that. I stopped counting after I spent 200 hours. I felt the time frame and the political environment and the full range of people where everybody wanted everything in those standards is, I feel the standards coming before you in February are much closer to what I wish we could have developed. I would have really have liked to have us had more focus and more coherence in those standards. So I think we are on the right track from the drafts I have seen. What you want to look for is this focus. Is there something at second grade that looks different than fourth grade, and it ought to look different than sixth grade and eighth grade? And yet you want to see a flow, but you don't want to see the same thing over and over at every grade level. We want a small number, the smaller the better, at every grade level. That's what the highest performing countries have. They focus on a few limited topics, and they teach them very well for 1 year. Not year after year after year. One of the documents being used by the committee is called Curriculum Focal Points. I have it here.
Ms. Nutting, excuse me for a second. Representative Murphy.
Thank you.
Yes.
What do you mean by a small number? A number of what?
A small number of benchmarking standards. Okay. Thank you for the clarification. In the curriculum focal points, this is one of the documents from the National Council of Teachers of Mathematics that the committee is using to guide its development. The number in here, Representative Murphy, is very small. It is 3 topics per grade level. That's quite small, but it's probably the direction you need to move toward. I don't think as a country or as a state we're quite ready to go to the 3, but this should be our guide. This is based, and it says in the introduction, it's based on what we know from the TIMSS international testing, that less is really more, that if we can really focus. But we need some specificity or people don't know what we're talking about. The standards themselves may also have some teacher notes which will give some of that specificity, and you need specificity in terms of test specifications to guide the assessment. But you want a carefully sequenced progression of learning, but not one that's redundant. And the last point, you want a balance of skills, processes, and concepts that lead to understanding. It's not just enough to do mathematics. You have to be able to understand and use mathematics. That's what our country needs to be internationally competitive. Anyone in the world can do mathematics. So the mantra I'm going to leave you with today is less is more. So what are some of the lessons from TIMSS? You may have heard this phrase that in the United States our curriculum is a mile wide but only an inch deep.
Excuse me, Ms. Nutting. I apologize. I think I'll probably be doing this a few more times. Representative Gladden, you have a question for Ms. Nutting.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I could have waited till the end, but I thought she was concluding. I wanted to make sure I got my question in. But it is, you know, often legislators add to the math curriculum with things like students need to learn to balance their checkbooks. Students need to learn to invest and to not just spend their money as they go and that sort of thing. And so I'm wondering, Mr. Chair and Ms. Nutting, what is your opinion of that sort of legislative help?
Ms. Nutting.
Yes, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I think, you know, we need to look at not taking mathematics down to just little itty-bitty things. Certainly we need the skills that people need to balance their checkbooks to have a productive life. So we want to make sure our kids can do the computation to balance it. But most of the time, I need to use really good estimation skills with my checkbook. Is there going to be enough money in there for this purchase? I need to have some idea of the range of what it will be. At some point, I need to sit down, probably with my calculator, and figure out to the penny what my balance is. So you need to have both of those skills in the curriculum. But the first one, that ability to estimate and think about, is the skill that's going to take me further into a wider range of mathematics. Also, it's one of those things, you know, you add deposits and you subtract what you take, but there gets to be those other little crazy things in how you set up your checkbook so that you have a good running total.
Ms. Fleming, I believe Representative Wardlaw has a question for you as well.
Yeah.
Okay. Perhaps when we do that, unless there's something really pressing on right here, and we can hold off and get you through your presentation, would that be okay, members? Okay. And is the technology not working for us here? Or?
It's okay. The user of the technology.
I see.
What I'm going to share now, this is the other disclaimer, I am not Bill Schmidt, but what I am sharing with you is a presentation that he gave to several business people here in Minnesota in July, and it is very similar to the presentation that was given last week. As a member of SciMath, I've been able to work with Bill Schmidt over a 10-year period. I've met with him personally 4 or 5 times, and I feel confident because of my knowledge of the TIMSS testing in presenting this for him and have his permission to share this with you. But he talked last week about education in a global context. He shared some of the problems like Representative Greiling was talking about. Let's just look at this one quickly. This one disturbs me a lot. If you look at the data at the bottom, only 50% of our fifth graders can do this problem. I'm a little less concerned about the third graders because actually we know from the internationally known researchers at our own University of Minnesota, from Professors Post, Kramer, and Weiberg, that fractions, truly understanding fractions, develops a little bit later for kids. But look at this problem. You know, kids should automatically eliminate C, 8 eighths.
they should know that's equal to a whole, and that's to the right of this interval that we're talking about. And they should know that 10 ace is more than a whole, too, and that I should eliminate. So now I'm down to two choices, and there's two ways I could actually get this right. If I look at one half, and I just have a visual sense, if you look at that interview from 0 to 1, one half is in the middle. And part of my conceptual understanding, if I know that half means it's the middle of the interval, I ought to see that that's the correct answer. If I also know that 4 ace is an equivalent name for one half, then I also should be able to choose B as the correct answer. Here's a second problem. A fairly simple subtraction problem, but something that begins to cause kids a little bit of stomach problems. But it's simple. You can put everything into 15ths, and it's a very simple subtraction problem, building off of what kids already know about subtraction. It's also pre-algebraic, because if you look at point E, 4/5, if I take 4/5 and take nothing away from it, that's how I get 4/5. If I take 4/5 and begin to take something away from it, 4/5 can't be the answer. When I get to 8th grade algebra, that's going to be known as A minus 0 equals A. That's one of the identity properties that algebra is founded on. So in order to get A, you have to subtract nothing from it to still get A. So even though we're working with whole numbers or working with fractions and not working with algebra yet or variables, it's these ideas in arithmetic that we have to help kids transition into algebra. Another problem here is linear algebra. This is something we will be expecting all of our eighth graders to do. And it's really a simple one. Look at that first part now. You've got to do a little simplifying here. Let's take that 3 times the 2x minus 5. Well, I have to distribute that 3 over the 2x and the 5, so I get 6x, and then I get 15. If I go back to whole numbers, let's suppose I was doing 3 times 56. Now, I could do that by regular computation, or I could do it by mental math. 3 times 56. What if 56, if I thought about it as 50 plus 6? Is that okay? Is 50 plus 6 another name for 56? Sure. 3 times 50 plus 6, the quantity 50 plus 6, means I do 3 times 50, that's 150. 3 times 6 is 18. I put those together and I have 168. It's the same thing I will do in algebra that I just did with whole numbers. We need to have teachers have the professional development to help kids make those transitions so kids don't freeze when they see this just because there's X's in it. Now, what Dr. Schmidt would say is what we found out from international studies is three things. There's coherence, there's focus, and there's rigor. These are things we have not had in our curriculum in the United States or in Minnesota to the degree that they appear in higher achieving countries. Coherence is the structure. There's a flow from one grade level to the next. What kids learn in arithmetic will be solidified as they and generalized when they move to algebra. The focus is what we've been missing, and I'm going to show you that in just a moment. And rigor is interesting. Rigor can be in the standards, but rigor is often more in the instruction and in the assessment. We can test something at a low level and fool ourselves that we think kids know it, or we can test it at a high level and know that they know it deeply. So rigor can be in the standards, or it can be something we have to develop more deeply in through professional development. Here's the world-famous diagram. This is what the top-achieving countries have in their curriculum. Notice how it looks a bit more like a triangle or a parallelogram or a trapezoid, you know, but it's not everything at every grade level. Look at grades 1 and 2 at the very top. There's a focus in high-achieving countries on just number, but not just doing the operation, understanding the meaning of the operation, and a focus on measurement. At 3rd grade, some additional topics come in, at 4th grade and 5th grade. But look at 6th grade as you go down the column. You notice things begin to disappear. At 7th and 8th grade, things disappear to make room for a new focus. This is what you need to look for in the standards. Are there threads across the standards, but are there things that disappear so new things can actually be taught? Or does our curriculum and our standards look like these countries? Now, this is not your screen that is out of focus or wiggling. This is just meant to be a visual. These line All those words are just those words. But look at the different shape of the dots. What we have in the United States and what we've had in the past in many Minnesota school districts is we try to do everything for everybody every year in the hopes that somehow, somebody learns something. Now, what we need to do is focus. We need to guarantee if we limit more what we are teaching each year, wouldn't we just do a better job of teaching it? Wouldn't that help guarantee that more kids would actually learn it and that we could actually build on it another year? And this is a secret for the achievement gap, too. If we really knew the focus, then we don't have to go back and redo everything a kid is missing. Because if you have to go back and reteach, then the rest of the kids are still passing by, and wouldn't the gap just keep staying the same? We've got to accelerate kids through the gap. We've got to find the focus of the most important things we need to reteach them, and that's what we need to do if we're ever going to get some kids to catch up. So instead of this all over the board, we're looking for more focus. I'm going to skip over these problems. There's a few here. This one is becoming less relevant to us. In the past, in the international studies and in comparison what happens in Minnesota and the United States, look at the blue bars. How many kids enter high school and they are taking their entry course is below Algebra 1? Your legislation will now radically change this graph. Because if we now have all kids having Algebra 1 as a background, we have them much farther ahead when they get to high school. But here's the dismal results for African-American learners. They were much more likely, the students taking Algebra 1 for the first time. You notice that white students are more likely to have done it in the past in 8th and 9th grade, but black kids in 10th and 11th grade are much more likely to be taking Algebra 1 as their first course. So we've had this disequity in who takes what when. And also, this graph is intended to show that the more you take Algebra 1 in the earlier, the more mathematics you will take throughout your career. And that means if we can get Algebra 1 under everybody's belt earlier, we can really open up the future mathematics the kids will take. And we need that if we're going to be internationally competitive. There's also the idea of how many courses teachers and districts and school boards will offer so kids can achieve our new standards. Look at District F. It happens to be an urban district. There are 46 different courses in their secondary, their middle school and high school. Other districts even have 17, 20, 21. Part of that is Algebra 1 here and Algebra 1A and Algebra 1B taught in this way and the old consumer math type things. Districts have had a wide variety. That has led to the spaghetti diagram that I'll show in just a moment. This diagram shows that when you have lots of courses, you have lots of pathways to get through the mathematics requirements. Look at that urban district F, 253 different paths through the mathematics curriculum from 7th grade through 12th grade. So it ends up looking like this. Mm-hmm. Something that any of you that have tried to help your child with high school course registration know well. But it means if we don't start on the right path, how do we help our kids navigate through this? We need to get more focused not just with our standards, but with our courses. How can we teach something that is really going to reach a wide range of learners? Again, how do we help our teachers really deliver on the standards? Another issue has been remediation. And while this looks like the number of students needing remediation in college has grown, you have to look that the enrollment in two-year colleges is also growing. So you need to look at it a little bit at it proportionally. But you also see that as the lighter gray bars or the gray bars on the bottom have been increasing, look also at the calculus, that white section has also increased. Statistics, the dotted, has increased. So we're seeing increases in other courses too. But here's what's going on with remediation. We have many kids taking forms of remediation in college, which means we haven't done everything we could in the K-12 system. It also means it's expensive for families in terms of tuition. Kids have to take the course, pay for it, but they often don't get credit for it. But here's the real value.
kids that take remediation are much less likely to earn a degree. They're already behind before they start. And kids say that there's many things that they've been missing in their presentation. I'm just going to share, breeze through these final slides and then end so there'll be time for questions. This is the 1995 TIMSS result. Some of your legislation also appropriated funding along with contributions from the business community to do TIMSS testing again this spring. While it could be as long as a year and a half before those results come in because of the complexities of the test, it is going to be fascinating to compare our 2007 achievement to our 1995 achievement. That's a dozen years later. I am really looking forward to that comparison. But here's our fourth grade math achievement. And you really have to look at the color band, not just the numbers. You see that at fourth grade, both the United States and Minnesota and the international mean are all in that white section in the middle. There's really no statistical difference there. You know, we can feel good that, you know, you don't have to feel bad that Minnesota was 3 points below. It's not really significant at that level. But look at the nations that score better than us and look at the nations that scored less than us. In eighth grade, Minnesota has a raw score that's above the United States and above the international mean, but basically everybody in that box is kind of in the same category. And look at the nations that outperform us. And then at 12th grade, Minnesota stays close to the average mean, but the United States even falls among the lowest performing countries. But what it says is, for math, in 1995, you know, reflection of what we've been doing for the last 10 to 15 years, our kids were just pretty typical average in terms of international comparison. But in science, the story was slightly different. Minnesota is in that middle group, but look at the number of nations at fourth grade. Only Korea outperforms us. At eighth grade, only Singapore outperforms us. And Minnesota was clearly at eighth grade above the United States and above the international mean. There was a study done to say, what's going on? Wait a minute. The same eighth graders in 1995 took the science test and the math test. Why would Minnesota eighth graders do better in science? And one of the things, several of the things we discovered were this. The science curriculum was more focused. In 1995, we had 7th graders doing life science and 8th graders doing earth science, or vice versa. But they had a focused year of science on a new topic. Also, there was very little ability grouping in science. By 7th grade, kids weren't just regurgitating their elementary school mathematics, and a few kids were studying algebra in 1995. What was happening in science was all kids had an opportunity to learn new science. And the test results show they can do it. The third thing that was happening was probably more focused professional development. The inquiry in science has been very strong among science teachers in Minnesota. Whereas in math, we have that seesaw that goes back and forth. Oh, should we go back to the basics or should we teach them more understanding? We've got to settle on what we know helps kids learn in math and teach good mathematics. So there's more slides that show much more detail. You'll find some things, for example, in science. We do very well in the life sciences and earth science, but less well in chemistry and physics. Another validation for your legislation to require that we have kids not just take biology, but chemistry or physics. So I think I'll stop with there and open it up to questions. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Ms. Nutting, for a powerful testimony. Actually, I'm going to ask Mr. Bill Linda Schuller to join you here for the remaining 15 minutes, and perhaps we can do sort of a tag team question and answer. We have a number of folks lined up. There's quite a bit, so if you can make your questions concise so we can get as many questions in as possible, I appreciate it. Representative Wardlaw.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is this working? Am I close to
it? It's working.
You were talking about this property a little while ago.
Uh-huh.
And I kind of disagree with the National Council of Teachers of Mathematics a little bit regarding calculators. I remember I was a math teacher teaching a geometry problem. And I said, hey, what's 16 times 12? It came up in something, finding the area, I don't know what it was. And of course, they all started reaching for their calculators.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, never mind, it's 192. And I said, how'd you do that? And I said, well, I know that 160 plus 32 is 192. And then it was, why? So I had to reteach the distributive property again, you know, to these kids that should have known it from eighth grade. And I remember teaching it in eighth grade to them, and this was in ninth grade anyway. And then I was talking to my wife, who teaches third grade, and they're just pushing calculators down into the first grade level. And I'm thinking, you know, I attempted to write some legislation, it'll never go anywhere, that bans calculators until grade six, because they don't know their time tables. And they couldn't go 3 times 15 in their head. They'd have to... Where are we at with that kind of stuff? You know, because calculators are extremely valuable. You know, in Algebra 2, the kids can look at some statistics, plot it, and if it clusters around a straight line, it's probably a linear equation. And if it goes in a curve, it could be exponential or parabolic. And if it doesn't, if it's just a big mess of dots, no equation. But the T83 calculator can do recursive on that and tell them what the equation is. That's what the calculator is for. It's also for the checkbook because it speeds things up. But there's some... Where am I wrong, or am I right?
Ms. Snyder, or Mr. Linda-Schuller. You get to tell Representative Wardlaw where he's wrong.
I think your last statement, that the calculator needs to be a tool, and we have to know when to use it wisely. When teachers or students are using it as a substitute for good mental math, that's not the best use of the calculator. So one of the things you do with kids is we need to show them things like that distributive property. We need to show them to do, 12 times 16, that it's 10 plus 2 times 16. And many curriculums now are doing more mental math like that with kids. So while we're doing that addition and subtraction focus in first and second grade, we need to get kids real flexible with doing the computation, doing the mental math, and showing them that their own brains can do it faster than the calculator. We can do lots of important relationships with basic facts, too. If I learn 7 plus 7, I know 7 plus 8. 7 plus 8 is really just 7 plus 7 plus 1. And if kids can make those relationships, they'll learn their basic facts and retain them because they can hook them to something besides just rote memory. And then I've got a whole bunch of mathematics that I'm using better for algebra. And your example, the 16 times 12, we could have done as an area model, too. I could do it as a room that's 16 feet by 12 feet, and I could break it into 10 feet and a 6-feet section and 10 and 2. And now I've got all these partial areas that, when I put them together, are really the whole area. That's a geometric explanation of even the traditional algorithm. So I think as teachers are integrating math more and getting the understanding behind the computation, then the calculator is only a useful tool to use when we need it. And we can explore very interesting patterns in mathematics with the calculator. So I don't want you to write that legislation, but I think we have to get teachers smarter with how to use the calculator as a tool rather than a substitute for good math.
So a word for strong professional development. Quickly, yes.
One follow-up. I still want to know their time tables. I say, get them out of their little hands until they're in sixth grade.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Nutting, in real life, I'm a social studies teacher, which, of course, the old saw, if I could have done math, I would have been a math teacher. I can't, so I'm a social studies teacher. After we passed the algebra requirement in eighth grade last year, and I teach eighth grade, I'm hearing from my math colleagues who are both excited about that new requirement, but also very concerned that there's some percentage of students who are simply not developmentally ready to tackle the more abstract nature of algebra at eighth grade, and kind of feel like we can beat them over the head with an algebra book, but that's not going to change their developmental abilities. Can you respond, what do we do with a kid who is bright enough and all of that, but simply isn't developmentally ready to tackle and be successful at algebra in eighth grade?
Ms. Nutty.
Yes, Representative Mariani, and I think you're right. If we teach it abstractly, not all kids will learn it. I totally believe that. We've got to find ways to make algebra more accessible to more kids. When I visited in Singapore, I was very much impressed that they have a syllabus that has the same math goals for all kids, but they tend to teach it in about three different ways. They do have a tracking there. For the kids that were in the lowest track, they learned it in a much more tangible, real-life way with much more auditory learning and much more experiential learning. Kids in the middle learned it with a combination of that, and kids at the high end learned it at a much more abstract level. So we may have some kids that function very well abstractly, and we could teach to that strength. I was sharing with Representative Mariani beforehand the work of Robert Moses. When he teaches algebra to kids, for example, in Boston, his daughter was struggling with mathematics several years ago with algebra. He took the kids on the subway system. The outbound was the positive numbers. The inbound was the negative numbers. And he taught them all about positive and negative integers and how you add and subtract the number of stops and how far you are away from the beginning, the zero point from which you started, in a real-life context. And he has developed ways to teach algebra where the number of kids of color in his program now graduate from high school in exceedingly large numbers and go on to college. So it's going to be very much about how we teach that algebra to kids. If we can connect it to some of their real-life experiences to give them a tangible way to generalize the patterns that they're seeing, and how do you express that, first of all, with numbers, and then how do you express it with these letters, and what do these letters mean? So I think it's going to be about how we teach it. I don't think it's beyond the scope of our kids, but I think we've got to make those transitions from their elementary curriculum to their middle school curriculum.
Representative Gutwall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, that was exactly where I was going. And
okay.
If I could ask the testifier for one more piece, both applied math and science, because I think there really is a key there. I watch my own five kids and their learning. And how much they light up when it's not just a bunch of numbers on a piece of paper, but they start thinking in terms of concepts and learning how to apply it. Kids today seem to be much more engaged. Their attention spans might be a little shorter because of the type of media they're dealing with. And so those applied approaches seem to be a real answer. And maybe you have some more research around that. I didn't hear it in your presentations. But then also the parental factor. I'm always interested in are statistics, is there research that suggests, you know, parental involvement makes a difference with this or doesn't in math and science?
Ms. Nutty.
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, I think the role of parents is critical. In fact, in one of Dr. Schmidt's other presentations, it showed that the highest achievement came when teachers were emphasizing more algebra in the curriculum and whether a parent had attended the university or not. So we've got to erase that type of got to make the playing field more level for kids whose parents may not have done the formal learning. I think the thing that we don't do in education well, as we've looked at new ways of teaching math, is we've got to include parents in this process. The minute we take away the power of parents to help their kids, we sabotage what we're trying to do by setting standards and raising things for kids. So we have to look at community ed, we have to look at our churches, we have to look at our community groups, because teachers can't do that all by themselves. And many parents, there's two types. Some very much like mathematics, some didn't. Those that like mathematics, it's real hard to figure out how your kid might not learn the same way you did. And if you were successful, you can't transfer that to your child, but how do you get your skills so you're re-empowered as a parent? So I think we have to help some parents re-experience some parts of mathematics. So that would be the thing I would like to see the department do, too, is to really do a parent communication effort after mm-hmm. the standards are in law.
Thank you. Excellent question also. Members, we're almost done with our time. I'm going to propose, I'm willing to stick around for another 10 minutes. There's a number of folks who have a number of questions. I don't want to bind committee members to that, though, so if you feel you need to leave, please do so. But I sense a lot of energy from committee members here on an engaging topic, and so I'm gonna say let's go another 10 minutes, and we'll get in a few more questions. But we are officially supposed to be adjourned at 9:30, so I won't hold members here beyond If you need to get up and go, please do so. So I'm going to jump over to Representative Swales.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to make a couple of comments, and that is that I'm an AP English teacher at Woodbury High School. And for the last year and a half, we have been trying to align the curriculum for AP English and a couple of other courses to the state standards. And what I want to comment on is your comments about focusing. What I am seeing in the standards and the frustration that many of us feel at applying the language arts to the standards is the continuous repetition from one year to another. I just love the concept of focusing. Mm-hmm. One thing that I also want to say in regards to that is that we are a five-star high school and have been for the last 2 years. There's only 11 five-star high schools in the entire state. And I think part of that is our attention to professional development. We have not a requirement, but a guide in the English department that all teachers attend AP training, which is subsidized by the state of Minnesota. And so everyone in our English department is trained at the AP level so that all of us have and introduce that level of rigor into our classroom. Some of us are working with at-risk kids, but we're still on the same playing field of talking about academic rigor when we are talking about the standards that apply to the state. I think that when one school is able to achieve that kind of rigor, that serves as a model for other schools, and we need to be talking about that on how can we make this a broader based thing. Another thing that we have done, we have professional learning communities in our school, which is based on the Adelaide Stevenson model in Lincolnshire, Illinois. Many of us have traveled to Stevenson High School, and I really think that the way they deliver mathematics to their students is very similar to the way you're talking about it, with constant reinforcement for those at-risk kids who don't have the home environment that the ones who do achieve well have. Our math department and English department have been working together, believe it or not. It's such a disparate discipline. But what we're finding is that we are reinforcing mathematics skills by taking language that is appropriate to both disciplines. I think that is another method that we can get to in using it. And are you seeing that kind of collaboration between disciplines in order to achieve higher in science and in math?
Ms. Snoddy.
Yes. Mr. Chair and members, I think you're exactly right. There's a study by Milbury that says from the effect of schools research that without exception, the main vehicle that caused student achievement to increase was professional learning communities. That is probably key, and we know that from the professional development literature right now. I think the greatest thing that's happened in Minnesota since we've had state standards is districts talking within themselves across grade level and across discipline. Mm. It makes me very hopeful about what's happening for education in Minnesota. And I think it's the only thing that's going to really help us improve. Focus is hard to achieve when you've got learning materials that are different in every district and you've got state standards, and that's the hard decision that teachers to cut and districts have to cut, is if there's this bigger umbrella of what we're supposed to teach, no materials are specifically written just for Minnesota standards. They're often written for Texas and California because they have huge adoptions. And every textbook publisher tries to do the opposite of what Tim's has shown, put everything in the textbook so you can sell it to every state. So that focus is very hard. So it does come down to individual teachers at a school site and within a district and across the district working together. You know, it just seems that that has to be essential. And mathematics is the handmaiden of lots of other disciplines. Not many kids, only 5% of our graduates over the last 30 years go specifically into mathematics and get a mathematics degree. But many, many disciplines require mathematics for success. You can't be a biologist without taking mathematics. You can't even be a social studies teacher or an economist without a good grasp of statistics and data. You know, maybe you don't need as much calculus. Maybe you need much more quantitative literacy and AP statistics rather than AP calculus. Because you cannot solve the economic problems and the social problems of this world without a good understanding of the data. And then you have to use that technology to get at that data to process it in a way that will make it useful for you.
Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I couldn't help. If you have to have a grasp of mathematics, Representative Daphne, how did you get... Never mind.
My students have been asking the same question.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. Ms. Nutting, I'm interested. You talked about the number of courses offered in number in districts, and you mentioned this one district F is an urban district that offered lots of different courses, and then you showed the chart that showed the multiple pathways. You didn't talk about the results, the learning of kids, and their achievement, and how it relates to the number of courses being offered, the number of different ways. At least I didn't catch it if you did. Do you have a comment on that? Do we see, if we have more courses offered, a wider variety of courses, do we find achievement any more or less or different?
Ms. Nutting or Mr. Bundeshova?
Mr. Chair and members, Bill and I are just talking. I don't know specifically about any study that has shown that. I think there's a few school districts that have, because of our state standards, have been focusing instruction because it's now you can't have a kid in a consumer math class and meet the high school graduation requirement. So I do know just of one school district that I've worked with where they took their geometry and they are using the same textbook for three different levels of geometry. And they have one called, you know, basic concepts of geometry. So they're taking the essence of that textbook and teaching it. And their achievement results are better than when they had the spaghetti bowl type of course. They wrestled with having 18 different math courses and are now down to about 9, you know, 3 in geometry, 3 in algebra, 3 in statistics, and then some of the AP courses. And they're seeing that by narrowing their focus and changing their teaching methods to make the content more accessible to more kids, their achievement results are moving upward. They're not leaping and bounding up there yet, but, you know, because it's a transition for everyone. But I think there's some preliminary research, but I would have to, I don't know who's been doing that.
Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I believe it was Superintendent Williams that talked about the concept of school districts kind of going toward lowering the class standards so more kids can achieve as opposed to trying to get the kids up to a level of achievement in the tougher courses. And I'm wondering if we're seeing a similar thing here, if you're talking about fewer courses. Fewer courses, meaning we're holding up the standards on the courses instead of lowering the course levels down so more can achieve, doing what we have to get the kids up to satisfy that. And I was looking for that correlation there after, because I thought that was very interesting when Superintendent Williams talked about that. So that was my...
I think we have time for one more question. Representative Tilbury, you get to ask it.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to the presenters, I really enjoyed that slide that you had with all the different courses of geometry, algebra, and so on. Just think of being a counselor and trying to put a student into the next class that they should be coming from a different school. Because if you just have that district F as one district, just imagine the 320-some other districts that are in our state. And what I struggle with, though, is it doesn't seem to be any agreement in the math world on how to do this. And you said parent involvement. Well, I belong in a school district or work in a school district as a counselor that has gone to an integrated approach only to then go back to something traditional because of the fight with the parents. Because parents feel that this isn't what we had, this isn't how we did it, and they're not going to be prepared, and they've gone to the wall on this. So we have ended up having to offer all these courses just to satisfy our parents. And so I'm trying to figure out where maybe we can be helpful to maybe focus, because we definitely need it.
Ms. Nutty?
Mr. Chair and members, I think this is a hard one. I think we've been through a decade of parents and educators waffling on this, and I think this is probably more my personal opinion than SciMath's official opinion. But I think a district has to settle one way or the other, because we've got to focus the learning. You've got to have less courses so you can pour your professional development into those courses. So we see in the national data now, finally, that the integrated programs have been out now for about a decade. We see that, in general, they are not causing damage to kids and that kids, in fact, get some additional reasoning skills in mathematics that are helpful. But I think, you know, it's still a local community decision on the learning materials we choose. But I think district should try to settle when our standards are in place. They need to stay in place now for a while. Part of our problem has been we're now on our third version of the standards in less than, 10 years. We need to get our standards in place. This time they have much more support from mathematicians and math educators together. We need to know that they're mathematically good mathematics content. And then we need to find the best curriculum materials and the best sequence of courses. So that's going to take a little time, and that's where we'll have to get that data and look for it. So I think how a district chooses is up to that district. And I think some kids will learn better if they can see algebra geometrically, and if they can learn ideas in geometry by connecting it to algebra. Some kids will learn that way better than the way we used to learn. So I think, parents and teachers and communities have to settle on something and go forward with it and set up a course structure that's more predictable, that where we know that the standards will not be watered down for some and, raised up for others, that we're going to get all kids to learn this kind of mathematics. But how we learn it has to be an important district decision.
Quick follow-up?
Yes, just one quick follow-up. As students have transferred in from other countries, what I have found as they transfer in, if I try to guess where they need to fit according to grade level and so on, I always find out that students from other countries are always more advanced than our own.
Mm-hmm.
More than not.
Mr. Chair and members, I think that's been true because internationally the achievement is higher, depending on what countries those kids come from. Now, I've taught in Minneapolis, too, and we've had many students that come in that have no formal education. So sometimes it will be a different situation. But very often they have had other levels of learning. The algebra standards are taught sooner in some other countries. So I think with the new legislation to put Algebra 1 in 8th grade, we will be closer to being on the same level of skills that's going on in other countries.
Ms. Nutting and Mr. Linda Scholler, thank you for both provocative and insightful testimony. Members, thank you for a very engaging session. It affirms my belief of the quality that's been assembled in this committee. And for now, this committee is adjourned until next Tuesday.